from deep inside your radio.
From London, England, ladies and gentlemen. And, you know, I know I shouldn't maybe sometimes, but I do. I read Twitter responses to me on Twitter, at the Harry Shearer. And one of them said this late this afternoon, London time, that he tunes in for the music and sometimes the snarky DJ. And I'm just thrilled that after this many years, I finally have my nom de radio. I've always gone by my own name, but from now on, I'm going to be sometimes the snarky DJ. You can just call me Times. Ladies and gentlemen, is this, as some people have the temerity to say, the most important election in a generation, or is it a lifestyle choice? You have here before us, as we careen towards Election Day, and oh, it can't get here soon enough, two people, two candidates, two major party candidates, who, from their own lips, we can divine the fact that they agree on the war in Afghanistan, how it's going, how it'll go, Social Security, what may have to happen to it, and more generally, as my guest Dr. Stephanie Kelton said on this broadcast last week, the whole construct of we got to cut back, we can't have these deficits. Speaking of which, parenthetically, the Stephanie Kelton discussion is now in transcript form at harryshearer.com if you want to point anybody in that direction. But look, this is a $2 billion election, ladies and gentlemen. Each side has raised at least $2 billion. As a matter of fact, probably more. Want proof? Let me read the trades for you. This is from Media Daily News. With less than a week to go, presidential year TV station political advertising revenues on pace to be nearly three quarters higher than in 2008. These are local stations. This isn't counting cable networks. I'm surmising. Surmise is, of course, a guess with a hat on. A consultant, SNL Kagan, no relation to Saturday Night Live, says TV station political advertising is expected to climb 68% from 4 years ago to $2.6 billion, up from $1.6 billion in 2008. The biggest gainers have expectedly come from big battleground states, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Florida. Concurring with other estimates, Kagan says Mitt Romney's campaign has outspent Obama in TV and radio advertising in these states, buying over $500 million on local broadcasters in those states. Kagan estimates the top 10 publicly held TV broadcast station groups will see a 57.5% average increase in political revenue over just 4 years ago. Total political revenue for these groups would be $625 million, almost a 50% increase from 2008. So, cui bono, it's Cher's brother-in-law, who benefits from the current political system? Political consultants and broadcasters. Well, they don't have any influence. That's a conclusion I could reach when I read the trades for you. But getting back to the subject at hand, so we have that money being spent. That's going to sort of select who these guys are going to be listening to. Folks who can help top up the billion or more that they need, supposedly, to reach right past us. So, you know, maybe this is all WWF type electioneering at this point, where they all yell as loudly as possible about how evil the other guy is, and then go take their paychecks from Vince McMahon at the end of the day. So is it a really significant decision we're making, ladies and gentlemen? Or is it just like, you know, like Southern Californians have been about their cars for years? You know, it's a Prius or Volvo thing, or it's a Mercedes or Beamer thing, or whatever you can afford. But it's basically not about where you're going or how you're going to get there. It's about who you are. Hello, welcome to the show.
Since you've been gone, an awesome change has come about. My life is different now. I'm not the same without you. I'm evolving at a really astounding rate of speed into something way cooler than what I was before. I feel much stronger than I have in years. My mind is sharp and my spirit sound. Now people tell me the shape of my face is changing. I've grown an inch taller since July. What in the world is going on? Please tell me. Without you, I now have eyes to see. Some other things to me. A future scape.
Leicester Square. You remember him in London, England. I'm Harry from an increasingly chilly Leicester Square in London, England. It does seem like winter. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. I'm actually sometimes the snarky DJ. And ladies and gentlemen, we're not number one. The United States is losing its luster, according to a new study that measures the brand of each nation. Isn't that appropriate after we invent that whole concept? What's your brand? Hey, dude, what's your brand? That replaces what's your sign, I guess. Labeled an iconic brand in decline, the U.S. is now ranked 8th in the world based on the Country Brand Index. Did you know such a thing existed, the CBI? I did not. Future Brand, the creators behind the CBI, acknowledge that the U.S., quote, is undeniably one of the most widely recognized country brands in the world, as opposed to, say, Gambia, thanks in large part to its major cultural exports. But, quote, successive fiscal crises, unquote, have helped tarnish the American brand, and the country, quote, faces huge challenges in an uncertain climate, unquote. Topping the Country Brand Index, any guesses? No. Switzerland. That's right. That's what you can accomplish when you just focus on making cuckoo clocks and secret bank accounts and cheese, the big three, followed by Canada, ladies and gentlemen. Canada. You see, Canada. Japan. Despite their lost decade, Japan's doing well. So I guess that didn't dent their brand. Sweden. Not sure how well their brand would be rated by fans of Julian Assange. New Zealand. Before you rate the New Zealand brand highly, check on the internet the steps that New Zealand has taken to become a offshore tax haven. Interesting stuff. The banks in New Zealand. You could be a bank in New Zealand, apparently. Australia and Germany. Those are the top ones on the Country Brand Index. Switzerland, Canada, Japan, Sweden, New Zealand, Australia, and Germany. The Antipodes well represented. Thank you very much. My pleasure. What country stands to be number one in the future, according to the survey? The United Arab Emirates. The CBI, in case you're wondering, was crafted using, quote, quantitative data from 3,600 opinion formers and frequent international business or leisure travelers, says Future Brand, which also considered the views of key audiences, residents, investors, tourists, and foreign governments in ranking a country's brand. And once again, they didn't ask me. But we're number 8 on the Country Brand Index, ladies and gentlemen. But as I say, because we invented that whole concept, there's a karma is a be you know what. And now, news of the warm, won't you? The award-winning news of the warm. Go figure.
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Thank you very much. Whoever that is. Ladies and gentlemen, sea levels are rising faster than expected from global warming. University of Colorado geologist Bill Hay has a good idea why. This is from Science Daily. The last official International Panel on Climate Change report projected a global sea level rise between 0.2 and 0.5 meters by 2100, but current sea level rise measurements meet or exceed the high end of that range, suggesting a rise of 1 meter or more by the end of the century, time enough for us Americans to figure out what a meter is. Quote, what's missing from the models used to forecast sea level rise are critical feedbacks that speed everything up, he says. This is the researcher, Bill Hay from the University of Colorado. He's a geologist. One of those feedbacks involves Arctic sea ice. The Greenland ice cap is another. And soil moisture and groundwater mining, he says. There's an Arctic sea ice connection. The melting sea ice does not itself raise sea level. Instead, it plays a role in the overall warming of the Arctic, which leads to ice losses in nearby Greenland and northern Canada. When sea ice melts, he says, there's an oceanographic effect of releasing more fresh water from the Arctic, then replaced by inflows of brinier, warmer water from the south. It's a big heat pump that brings heat to the Arctic. That's not in any of the models, he says. That warmer water pushes the Arctic towards more ice-free waters, which absorb sunlight rather than reflect it back into space, as sea ice does. The more open water there is, the more heat gets trapped in the Arctic, and the warmer things can get. Then there are those gigantic stores of ice in Greenland and Antarctica. During the last interglacial period, sea level rose 10 meters due to the melting of all that ice without help from humans. New data suggests the sea level rise in the oceans took place over a few centuries, according to Hay. You can lose most of the Greenland ice cap in just a few hundred years, not thousands, under natural conditions. There's no telling, he says, how fast it can go with this spike of CO2. Another missing feedback is the groundwater being mined all over the world to mitigate droughts. That water is ultimately added to the oceans. All of these are positive feedbacks speeding up the changes in climate and sea level rise. He says you would expect negative feedbacks to creep in at some point, but in climate change, every feedback seems to go positive. He says the reason is that Earth's climate appears to have certain stable states. Between those states, things are unstable and can change quickly. Quote, under human prodding, he says the system wants to go into a new climate state. Perhaps Nevada. And halving the amount of nitrogen fertilizer used in certain areas of China would substantially decrease greenhouse gas emissions without affecting crop productivity and the area's natural carbon sink, according to a new study published November 1st in Environmental Research Letters. It shows that a 60% reduction in fertilizer use would significantly reduce emissions from areas that are anyway over-fertilized, such as the North China Plain. How is North China? Plain. And middle and lower reaches of the Yangtze River Basin. China's over-reliance on nitrogen-based fertilizer has dramatically increased its emissions of nitrous oxide, the most potent greenhouse gas. Since 2002, the warming effect caused by nitrous oxide has been significantly greater than the cooling effects from the croplands storing carbon dioxide, croplands nourished by the fertilizer, the nitrogen fertilizer. So it's out of balance now. According to the researchers, the warming effects of nitrogen fertilizer induced nitrous oxide emissions are now in China are much greater than the cooling effects of the crops caused by the fertilizer uptake. Co-author of the study, Dr. Han Quin Tian, said nitrogen fertilizer has become less efficient in recent years as the nitrogen input has surpassed nitrogen demands of plants and microbes. We're overfeeding them. The Chinese are. Excess nitrogen is not stimulating plant growth, but leaving the system through leaching and nitrous gas emissions. No jokes. The news of the warm, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Now, news of the godly. A court in Las Vegas has ordered the Catholic diocese in Green Bay, Wisconsin, that's a long reach, the long arm of the law, ladies and gentlemen, to pay a sex abuse victim $500,000. Somebody hit the jackpot in Vegas. The court found the church neglected to protect the boy from known sex offender and former priest John Patrick Feeney. The person involved is known in the Nevada legal system as John Doe 119. The plaintiff's lawyer says Feeney abused the teenage boy soon after leaving Green Bay. Feeney ended up landing in Las Vegas at St. Francis de Sales, where this kid and his family were parishioners, says the plaintiff's attorney. And Feeney laid his hands on this kid in a way no priest ever should. Anderson alleged church officials in Nevada let Feeney transfer to Las Vegas without revealing a history of sexual abuse against him. And no, the church in Green Bay is not owned by the whole community, unlike the Packers. The lawyer says Green Bay gave him a recommendation knowing he had a history of molestation. Officials with the Green Bay Catholic Diocese would not comment. Isn't that nutty? Go figure, department. News of the godly. As always, copyrighted for your protection. And now, ladies and gentlemen, now nothing happens. Oh, and I know why. Because I pushed the wrong button. News from outside the bubble. Joke's on me. The images, this from the Guardian newspaper in London, the images from the summer of 2010 were undoubtedly gruesome. The carcass of a young sperm whale, decayed and partially eaten by sharks, sighted at sea south of the Deepwater Horizon spill. It was the first confirmed sighting of a dead whale since the BP oil spill in Mexico in April of that year. The photographs, along with a cache of emails obtained by the campaign group Greenpeace under the Freedom of Information Act and made available to the Guardian, offer a rare glimpse into how many whales came into close contact with the gusher during the spill. They also show Obama administration officials tightly controlling information about whales and other wildlife caught up in the disaster. The plight of wildlife caught up in the spill, especially endangered species such as sea turtles and sperm whales, has enormous financial implications for BP, now revealed to be a British company. They asked a judge in New Orleans this week to finalize its $7.8 billion settlement for economic damages resulting from the spill, but BP still faces claims from the federal government for environmental damages, and accounting for wildlife killed as a result of the spill will be critical to the final bill. That looming legal struggle was apparently already on the minds of officials at the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration when crew aboard the research vessel Pisces spotted a dead sperm whale on the morning of June 15, 2010. That was the first confirmed sighting of a dead whale since the blowout. There's no further indication in an email released about what happened to any of the rest of the group of whales spotted, or indeed any of the whales that may have been exposed to BP oil. Unless animals are tagged, they're nearly impossible to relocate as they move great distances quickly and stay submerged for prolonged periods of time, said a NOAA spokesman in an email. In any event, the U.S. government would not disclose how many, if any, whales might have died or been directly affected by the spill because of legal reasons, said the NOAA spokesman. In contrast, the discovery of the decomposed carcass set off a flurry of emails with repeated instructions from NOAA officials to crew aboard the Pisces, the research ship, not to release information or photographs. The crew were also directed to obtain samples from the whale to try to determine if it was killed as a result of the spill and to mark the corpse. The gag order rankled with some aboard the Pisces. The attempt to shut out the media also sat uneasily with Greenpeace. NOAA did put out a press release about the dead whale. However, the release was edited and shortened in a way which appeared to minimize the effects of oil on whales. That information may never surface. There were believed to be about 1,200 sperm whale in the Gulf of Mexico at the time of the spill, making it one of the biggest populations of the world at the time. However, scientists concede little is known about how whales respond to oil spills, even in an area as heavily drilled as the Gulf of Mexico. Few whales strand on land. It's practically impossible to carry out necropsies at sea. We do know that oil spills do kill whales, but we know very little about how lethal they are and what makes them lethal, says Hal Whitehead, cetacean research biologist at Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia. NOAA scientists working with Oregon State have been tracking a number of sperm whale in the Gulf through satellite transmitters since the spill. There isn't at least anything published that has clear linkages between sperm whale that got covered in oil and died in the same way, says Bruce Mates, who heads the Marine Mammal Institute at Oregon State. And with the one whale carcass recovered so far, scientists were not able to establish the definitive cause of death because the animal was so badly decomposed. Due to ongoing litigation issues, says the NOAA spokesperson, we are not able to discuss this aspect of our investigation. Oh, and wait, there's more. On another subject, the ongoing widening scandal involving the British DJ TV presenter Jimmy Savile, now accused of perhaps more than, well, a lot of, maybe it's in the hundreds of young girls, and now recently also young boys in the course of, did I say what he did to them? Oh, I didn't. Molesting in the course of his hosting duties. There are reports that the Catholic Church may try to revoke the papal knighthood it granted to Savile, even though the title presumably formally dies with the recipient. Yes, the Catholic Church is going to try to, or reported to be considering, revoking the papal knighthood of a civilian for child molestation. It's a nutty old world. And Gary Glitter, yes, has been arrested in relation to the police inquiry into the sexual abuse by Jimmy Savile. Scotland Yard detectives have received information from, as I said, more than 300 alleged victims. Glitter, whose real name is Paul Gadd, who knew, was detained last Sunday in central London. He was jailed for 4 months in the UK about 15 years ago after admitting possessing a collection of 4,000 hardcore photographs of children being abused. And he was sentenced to 3 years in jail by a Vietnamese court for sexually molesting two girls. He's always maintained he was innocent of the charges, which is a good move on his part, I think, since he's got that he's got that record that keeps being played at ball games, and you don't want people going da 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 child molester da da. So anyway, a Scotland Yard spokesman said officers working on the investigation have arrested a man in his 60s. That was Gary Glitter. And there are other celebrities being involved in the scandal as well. Maybe one day I'll bring you up to date on them. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And we know that northern Mali in Africa, as a result of unrest in that country, has apparently been taken over by an affiliate of Al-Qaeda, which is a good reason for us to have troops in Afghanistan. So we know that about Mali. We don't know really all that much these days about Malawi. But here's Jane Lynch from Can't Take a Hint with an update.
Charity. I'm a charity.
from London. This is the show. Ladies and gentlemen, the new Iraq. Obama, President Obama's former ambassador to Iraq, who served during the withdrawal of U.S. forces, was in favor of keeping some troops in Iraq past the 2011 withdrawal date. Just couldn't happen because the U.S. insisted on immunity for the troops, and Iraq wouldn't go along with that. You know that. This is in an interview with foreignpolicy.com's The Cable. He says, I think every leader I've encountered in Iraq has dictatorial tendencies. Maliki just happens to be the one who's the prime minister. This is Jim Jeffrey, former U.S. ambassador, from 2010 until this past June. He said he regrets the Iraq war was initiated in 2003 without a clear plan to get out. Yeah, where was Colin Powell with his doctor? Oh, and said that the idea of the United States, that the United States would be able to craft Iraq into a model of Western-style democracy in the middle of the Middle East was always naive and misguided. Quote, in most cases, it takes decades for countries, yes, indeed, to shape up. Shape up. So us thinking that in the short run we could fix this in Iraq was totally wrong, he said. Jeffrey said he saw the situation in Iraq as, quote, a glass half full, unlike some who see it as a glass half broken. And, ladies and gentlemen, news of AFPAC. Afghanistan will struggle to maintain its security forces, buildings, and equipment after foreign forces leave at the end of 2014. A U.S. government watchdog says in a bleak report that raised serious questions about long-term stability prospects. Really? In Afghanistan? The Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction has also announced an audit into $230 million worth of repair parts ordered for the Afghan army that have gone missing. The $50 billion effort to train Afghan security forces initially focused on fighting skills needed to face the Taliban. Critics of Wong warned this meant equally important capacities, including logistics networks that can get food, fuel, and ammunition to soldiers out in the field, were being neglected. U.S. and NATO are now rushing to correct this imbalance, according to The Guardian, but may have started too late. Afghanistan will struggle to maintain facilities that cost the U.S. government nearly $12 billion to build, according to the Special Inspector General's report. It added, quote, the Afghan government continues to face challenges that will likely prohibit it from being able to fully sustain Afghan National Security Forces facilities after the transition and the expected significant decrease in U.S. support. Lack of sufficient numbers and quality of personnel, as well as undeveloped budgeting, procurement, and logistics systems. Well, you can contract that out, can't you? I think there's a line of companies willing to. The army is doing better than police, who've not put in place the employees or systems needed to be self-sustaining and instead still rely on the U.S. and NATO, according to the report. As a result, says the report, U.S. funds invested in the construction and maintenance are at risk of being wasted. One particularly serious challenge is high illiteracy among new recruits, the legacy of a weak education system, and three decades of war. Training centers aim to teach recruits basic reading and writing at the same time that they learn to handle a weapon. That's got to work out okay. Yeah, you just fired the thing that says trigger. That's a T. The education needed to manage complex systems cannot be delivered in a few weeks, says the report. Fewer than 40% of organization and management positions were filled in June this year, the report said. There's also a shortage of technicians able to handle key issues such as water supply, sewage disposal, and electricity. Logistics networks have been undermined by serious fraud. Not the funny kind of fraud. That would be okay. Serious fraud, which is now endemic in much of Afghanistan. The planned audit into missing spare parts for the army came after inspectors discovered almost all of 500 shipping containers had gone astray. The loss may have triggered another $137 million in spending on replacements. I got that on me. It's just the latest of corruption concerns unearthed by the Special Inspector General. And other reports indicate Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, has complained about negative depictions of the prospects for Afghanistan post-2014 in American media, in Western media. He's also complained that the effort on the part of the West may well fail because of it's concentrating on insurgents in Afghanistan as opposed to what's going on next door in Pakistan. So he's making the not happy sounds that Western observers have at this point, at least some of them, learned to shrug off as, oh, that's just Karzai. And this is too.
From Afghanistan Public Radio, where the pledge drive never ends.
From the newly refortified presidential palace in downtown Kabul, now with digital cable TV tiers, I'm Mahmoud.
And I'm Hamid. We're Cluck and Pluck, the Screw-It Brothers. Welcome to another edition of Karzai Talk. Today's program comes to you with the assistance of the Afghan Defense Forces, blowing up suicide bombers before they do.
Big week, my older brother.
Ah, very big week. Mm-hmm. The United States goes to the polls in an election.
And this time we get to wonder about the fairness of their election process.
From what I hear, their voting machines are as crooked as your side of the family.
Wait a minute. My side is your side.
I know.
Of course, our hearts go out to the people of the American East Coast, mm-hmm. whose suffering in the wake of the superstorm has been so great, they are almost living like Afghans now.
That is suffering. Very distressing. So did you send a contribution to the Red Cross or anything?
Well, I saw the All-Star Benefits show on the internet. Mm-hmm. And I gave it 2 likes on the Facebook.
Wait a minute. How can you give 2 likes?
Same way I can vote twice.
The unitary executive.
Thank you, George Bush. Hello, you're on Karzai Talk.
Hi, this is Mitt, a long-time candidate, first-time caller.
Mitt, don't you have better things to do 2 days before the election than to talk to us?
As it turns out, I don't. No. I know there's been some tension in the relationship between you and the current administration. I just want you to know that if I get elected, we'll be friendlier to our friends, more enemy-like to our enemies, and whichever you decide to be, you can count on that.
Well, of course, not only the whole country, but the whole Karzai family is a friend to America. Mm-hmm. And 3 words sum up that feeling.
And those would be, God bless America.
No. Your check's clear.
You know, Mitt, the only tension that we have is over some Americans saying that we will fall apart the day that you leave.
Oh, no, I would never say that. I'd give it a good 6 months. But seriously, like the president, I think our strategy in Afghanistan is the right one.
Well, do you think Pakistan could do more to help?
Oh, sure. They could give me a couple million for TV ads. But Hamid, I would ask you one thing if I become president.
Oh, what's that?
Please take your meds.
Thanks for calling. I wonder what he meant by that. I always take my meds, except on Thursdays.
Well, of course. You want to come down for the Sabbath. Mm-hmm. Hello, you're on Karzai Talk.
Hey, guys. Hillary here, longtime cabinet member, second-time caller.
Hillary, you know we love to get women callers on the show, but...
I'm wearing a burqa, I swear.
Okay, to what do we owe the pleasure?
Well, you'd know better than I would. But I'm calling because our rapid response team heard Mitt Romney's call and thought we should respond rapidly.
Well, not that there's anything wrong with a call from the number 3 person in your executive branch, the president is busy campaigning?
No, it's the first weekend of the NBA season. Ah. Anyway, I just wanted you to know that this administration is every bit as convinced of the wisdom of our Afghanistan policy as our opponent is. We believe that you'll be ready to handle your responsibilities in 2 more years, and that...
You can take off the training wheels.
Oh, I'd say it's more a matter of taking away your learner's permit and giving you the full license with... perhaps a limitation on operating at night.
Hey, if we controlled the countryside at night, I wouldn't have to do the radio gig.
That's true. We still have this neighbor problem, though, Hilary. Mm-hmm. My younger brother has said more repeatedly than he's asked me for money.
Don't start. But, yes, it's true. Living next to Pakistan is like...
I know what it's like. It's like living next door to a very loud Christian rock band with some heavily armed roadies.
I wouldn't know, but I'm laughing anyway.
It's form.
But you can believe me. The roadies we wouldn't be going after with predator drones.
Oh, no. You might accidentally kill some groupies.
Do they still have groupies?
You'd have to ask Bill. Well, hope to see you soon. Good luck with the Toyota dealership, Mahmoud.
If you know anybody who'd like to bail that out, let me know.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
I didn't call.
We had help today from the Super PAC Foundation. We speak on behalf of the Money That Talks.
Legal services for Cars I Talk from the law firm of Ketchum and Newcomb. I'm Mahmoud.
And I'm Hamid. Join us again for another edition of Cars I Talk. This is APR, Afghanistan Public Radio.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week, just like that.
We're so sorry.
Man convicted for a botched armed robbery that he didn't commit was overwhelmed by emotions after a Brooklyn judge apologized to him this week and formally dismissed all charges against him. I feel like somebody else, said Lawrence Williams, 36, who 2 years ago was slapped with a 10-year sentence for assault and has fought for exoneration ever since. He was locked up at Rikers Island for 3 months as he waited the trial for the 2008 stick-up over a gold chain. He then spent 26 months in an upstate New York prison. Private investigators managed to locate the real gunman whose DNA matched a T-shirt found at the scene. That man, Tavon Hutchinson, confessed to the crime, then confirmed the confession to a private detective over the to a police detective over the phone, but his current whereabouts are unknown. So it's unclear whether he'll be prosecuted for the shooting. After the DA was alerted, its conviction integrity unit took up the probe and agreed Williams had been wrongfully convicted, consenting to his release back in April. Alec Lemon caught a one-yard touchdown pass from quarterback Ryan Nassib with 3 seconds remaining, giving Syracuse a thrilling 37-36 come-from-behind Big East college football victory over South Florida. Unfortunately, Time Warner cable subscribers in the capital region of New York State didn't see the winning touchdown that capped the rally. The game was on Time Warner Cable's Information Channel 1. The channel is used for overflow sports programming. The game started at 7. At 10:30, when there was 36 seconds left in the game, it went off the air and the info channel resumed because Time Warner Cable had the game on a 3.5-hour timer, which proved to be a mistake. Ever done that? Sure. In an email Sunday, Time Warner Cable apologized to Syracuse football fans. We're sorry for the programming interruption. The game ran longer than anticipated, and Channel 1 automatically returned to regularly scheduled programming. We'll be sure to learn from this when planning overflow coverage on Channel 1 in the future, unquote. Yes, I'm sure. Fans and columnists reacted in outrage when a video of Chicago rapper Lil Reese beating a woman in a video clip leaked online earlier this week. Initially, Lil Reese responded on Twitter by calling the people who uploaded the video haters and confirming it was him. Several years ago, now Lil Reese has changed his tune and apologized for his actions. He took again to Twitter, explaining he had made a mistake that was out of character and has matured since. Quote, everybody makes mistakes. I was out of character and I've grown since then, since, S-E-N-S-E. Don't judge me for my past. I can admit my wrongs and I apologize. Deadline Toronto, President Choice Foods has apologized for an insensitive tweet about Hurricane Sandy that has left many Canadians with a bad taste. The private label of food conglomerate Loblaw posted Tuesday, what's scarier, Hurricane Sandy or a beverage with marshmallow eyeballs? It linked to a recipe for marshmallow bloodshot eyeballs, which suggests cutting marshmallows in half and putting a grape or blueberry in the middle to make it look like an eyeball. Isn't that sweet? The account was flooded with replies criticizing the tweet as awful and tasteless for making light of the storm that killed more than 100 people, including a woman in Toronto. President's Choice tweeted again about an hour later to say, It was sorry. We sincerely apologize for the insensitive tweet, the company wrote. We understand the seriousness of the storm and didn't intend to make light of it. Here, have an eyeball. The ruling Senarai Party presidential hopeful Park Jun-hai apologized this week in Korea, South Korea, for her late father Park Chung-hee's authoritarian rule and pledged to push for sweeping change that can open a new chapter for Korea. In a speech made at the memorial service for President Park, the 60-year-old politician said credit for the achievements made when he was in power should be given to the people, while she will bear the pain and suffering committed during his 18 years in office. It is now time to let my father go, she said, expressing deep remorse to everyone hurt by the chief executive, who was assassinated 33 years ago. After testing a British court's patience with a not-so-apologetic public statement, Apple Computer is finally eating humble pie. Apple has reissued and updated its Samsung apology statement on its British website after a British Court of Appeal found it to be the original statement to be untrue and incorrect. This comes after weeks of back and forth from the UK courts after Samsung scored a rare legal win over Apple after the iPhone and iPad maker lost an iPad design patent suit it brought in the British court against rival tablet maker Samsung. Here's a little tune. On October 16th, British High Court Judge Colin Burse originally ruled that Apple must run notices on its UK website and in a number of UK print publications stating that Samsung did not infringe Apple's patents and not breach UK law. That the notice, he ruled, must stay on Apple's site for a month. Samsung complained to a court of appeal that an earlier version of Apple's statement was inaccurate. On Thursday, Apple was ordered to remove the statement with which the technology giant embellished the apology with additional detail that was not sanctioned by the court. Wonder who else tries to do this. Apple's UK website now admits its previous statement was not compliant with the court. In losing that rare patent battle in the British courts, Apple had included in its own opinion in the statement along with the court-ordered text in a bid to lessen the impact. No, nobody else would try that. After 6 years of fighting, George Rodriguez finally got a promise that he'll get paid by the city that wronged him. The 52-year-old was exonerated by DNA evidence in 2004 after serving 17 years behind bars for the kidnapping and rape of a 14-year-old girl. It was faulty evidence from the Houston Police Department crime lab that put him there. On Friday, City Mayor Anise Parker and other officials offered apologies for the sins of past administrations and assurances that such a miscarriage of justice won't happen again. The mayor told the TV cameras the city would pay him $3 million and said, anyone who has a heart, who has any compassion at all, owes Mr. Rodriguez an apology. She apologized for everything except the one thing she had control over since taking office in 2010, according to the Houston Chronicle, the city's decision to fight Rodriguez's compensation for 2 years at every turn. Well, you can't have it all. After an outcry from the Native American community over the Cowboys and Indians theme of their latest video, the band No Doubt has pulled the video from YouTube and issued an apology on their official website. As a multiracial band, our foundation is built upon both diversity and consideration for other cultures. Our intention with our new video was never to offend, hurt, or trivialize Native American people, their culture, or their history. Although we consulted with Native American friends and Native American studies experts at the University of California, we realize now we have offended people. This is of great concern to us, and we're removing the video immediately. We sincerely apologize to the Native American community and anyone else offended by this video. Being hurtful to anyone is simply not who we are. Unquote. A rock band talks like that. Does research with a Native American expert. I blame the University of California. If it weren't for the budget cuts, that wouldn't have happened. National Public Radio has apologized to Abigail Evans, who was brought to tears over the amount of media coverage given to the presidential elections. Evans drew a fair amount of media attention after her mother uploaded a video of the four-year-old brought to tears over the elections. Her mother asked her why she was crying, and the girl replied that she was tired of Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney. She got Mitt Romney's name right. It'll be over soon, Abby, her mother replied. The election will be over soon. Abby managed a measly okay, but tears continued to run down her face. In response, NPR correspondent Mark Memmott offered an apology on the organization's website. On behalf of NPR and all the news outlets, we apologize to Abigail and all the many others who probably feel like her. We must confess the campaign's gone on long enough for us, too. Now, here's the latest NPR poll. No, he didn't say that. Why would he say that? Because, One of Colombian guerrilla group FARC's most notorious kidnappers, aptly named the Jailer, has asked his victims for forgiveness this week. Captured FARC combatant Eli Mejia Mendoza asked for forgiveness from his own hostage victims and their families during a public hearing in the central Colombian city of Villavicencio. Looking at the mistake I made and based on all the damage I've done, I apologize, a contrite former guerrilla told his former prisoners and families of kidnapping victims. I apologize because I've done a lot of damage to the world for having belonged since the age of 10 to gangs and afterwards to leftist guerrillas, FARC. And both Hyundai and Kia have acknowledged overstating fuel economy in several of their vehicle models, such as the Hyundai Elantra. What is an Elantra, anyway? The two major Korean automakers operating in the U.S. have acknowledged overstating the fuel economy by as much as 6 miles per gallon. During a routine audit by the Environmental Protection Agency, the makers will now face government sanctions that could add up to millions of dollars in fines. They promised to refund money to buyers, but also could face lawsuits other makers have been hit with after promoting inaccurate mileage or performance numbers. Most of the model's numbers were overstated by 1 or 2 miles per gallon. The Kia Soul will have to adjust its claims by a full 6 miles per gallon. Quote, we're extremely sorry about these errors, said Hyundai Motor America CEO John Krafcik. We're adding, we're driven to make them right. Meanwhile, Michael Sprague, the marketing chief for Kia Motors of America, also apologized. So, as usual, buyer beware. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast, and time for one more copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Right here.
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
A federal investigation into how guards at a Tennessee nuclear weapons plant got copies of questions in advance of written security skills testing has called on the Department of Energy to improve its oversight of private contractors. DOE Inspector General Greg Friedman said in a report this week the questions were widely distributed among security officers at the plant in Oak Ridge. Similar compromises may have occurred at other Department of Energy nuclear sites and not been discovered, the report concluded. Whew. That's a relief. The failure to properly safeguard the test prior to its administration, especially given the intense focus on Y-12, the plant in question, and security concerns at the site, was, in our opinion, inexplicable and inexcusable, the report said. The plant came under scrutiny after it took hours for guards to respond in July when three anti-nuclear protesters cut perimeter fences, made their way to the building that houses the uranium, and defaced it with spray paint and blood. The report said the, quote, eyes-on, hands-off approach to contractor governance by the National Nuclear Security Administration contributed to the security test being compromised in August. In a written response, the Department of Energy challenged the recommendation, saying the high cost would outweigh the benefit. Whew, that's a relief. And just days after an inspector general report revealed that a giant Pentagon contractor performed unsatisfactory work in Afghanistan, the U.S. Air Force awarded the firm another multi-million dollar pot of cash because accountability is contagious. This is DynCorp given a contract for $72 million just a week after the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan blasted the company for performing unsatisfactory construction work at an Afghan army base. The Army Corps of Engineers chose to settle DynCorp's contract rather than contest it because the Army Corps knows so much about accountability. Speaking of which, I certainly hope that whoever wins the election this week, now that it's relevant to the East Coast, I certainly hope that whoever wins the election this week actually looks back and reads up on what happened to New Orleans before deciding to give the Army Corps of Engineers billions of dollars to build big new faulty stuff to protect New York. News of the Inspectors General, ladies and gentlemen. Get your plurals right, man. Sometimes. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide, throughout Europe, the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world to the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, on the Mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com, as available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And we just like the benefits exceeding the costs if you'd agree to join us at the end. Would you? Already, thank you very much, huh? If you're in London town or coming over here, a first of its kind for me, CD launch of Can't Take a Hint, live, played live with Alice Russell, Danny Thompson, Charlie Wood, Judith Owen, a lot of guest stars. One night only, November 23rd, at Under the Bridge in London. You can check my website for details, if you so desire. And Jane Lynch's performance of Like a Charity is, as I mentioned, on Can't Take a Hint. You could stream it or download it or ignore it, as is your wont. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead, and thanks to Adrian Bodnam, Bodders, here at Global Radio in London. At this whole Global Radio obsession for helping with today's broadcast. And as mentioned earlier, or as alluded to earlier, this broadcast is represented on Twitter at The Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions. It is an actual productions. And it originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community known around the world, ladies and gentlemen, as the home of the Rubber Promise, and known also around the world as the home. Say it with me now. Of the homeless.